Found, luck with us will then abound. What we seek for shall be found in the land of solid ground. A bulging sack remained at Stilgar's feet. He crouched, placed his palms against it. Someone came up beside him, crouched at his elbow, and Paul recognized Chani's face in the hood shadow. Jamis carried 33 liters and 7 3/32 seconds drachms of the tribe's water, Chani said. I bless it now in the presence of a Seadina. Ekeri Akairi, this is the water. Filisin Folasi of Paul Muad'Dib. Kivi Akavi, nevermore Nakalas. Nakelas, to be measured and counted, Ukair An, by the heartbeats, Jan, 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 of our friend, Jamis. In an abrupt and profound silence, Chani turned, stared at Paul. Presently she said, Where I am flame, be thou the coals. Where I am dew, be thou the water. Bilal Kaifa, intoned the troop. To Paul Muad'Dib goes this portion, Chani said. May he guard it for the tribe, preserving it against careless loss. May he be generous with it in time of need. May he pass it on in his time for the good of the tribe. Bilal Kaifa, intoned the troop. I must accept that water, Paul thought. Slowly he arose, made his way to Chani's side. Stilgar stepped back to make room for him, took the balaset gently from his hand. Kneel, Chani said. Paul knelt. She guided his hands to the water bag, held them against the resilient surface. With this water the tribe entrusts thee, she said. Jamis is gone from it. Take it in peace. She stood, pulling Paul up with her. Stilgar returned the balaset, extended a small pile of metal rings in one palm. Paul looked at them, seeing the different sizes, the way the light of the glow globe reflected off them. Chani took the largest ring, held it on a finger. 30 liters, she said. One by one she took the others, showing each to Paul, counting them. 2 liters. 1 liter. 7 water counters of 1 drachm each. 1 water counter of 3 30-seconds drachms. In all, 33 liters and 7 3/32 seconds drachms. She held them up on her finger for Paul to see. Do you accept them? Stilgar asked. Paul swallowed, nodded. Yes. Later, Chani said, I will show you how to tie them in a kerchief so they won't rattle and give you away when you need silence. She extended her hand. Will you hold them for me? Paul asked. Chani turned a startled glance on Stilgar. He smiled, said, Paul Muad'Dib, who is Usul, does not yet know our ways, Chani. Hold his water counters without commitment until it's time to show him the manner of carrying them. She nodded, whipped a ribbon of cloth from beneath her robe, linked the rings onto it with an intricate over and under weaving, hesitated, then stuffed them into the sash beneath her robe. I missed something there, Paul thought. He sensed the feeling of humor around him, something bantering in it, and his mind linked up a prescient memory. Water counters offered to a woman. Courtship ritual. Watermasters, Stilgar said. The troop arose in a hissing of robes. 2 men stepped out, lifted the water bag. Stilgar took down the glow globe, led the way with it into the depths of the cave. Paul was pressed in behind Chani, noted the buttery glow of light over rock walls, the way the shadows danced, and he felt the troop's lift of spirits contained in a hushed air of expectancy. Jessica, pulled into the end of the troop by eager hands, hemmed around by jostling bodies, suppressed a moment of panic. She had recognized fragments of the ritual, identified the shards of Chakobsa and Botani Jib in the words, and she knew the wild violence that could explode out of these seemingly simple moments. "John, John, John," she thought. "Go, go, go." It was like a child's game that had lost all inhibition in adult hands. Stilgar stopped at a yellow rock wall. He pressed an outcropping, and the wall swung silently away from him, opening along an irregular crack. He led the way through, past a dark honeycomb lattice that directed a cool wash of air across Paul when he passed it. Paul turned a questioning stare on Chani, tugged her arm. "That air felt damp," he said. "Shh," she whispered. But a man behind them said, "Plenty of moisture in the trap tonight. Jameis's way of telling us he's satisfied." Jessica passed through the secret door, heard it close behind. She saw how the Fremen slowed while passing the honeycomb lattice, felt the dampness of the air as she came opposite it. "Wind trap," she thought. "They've a concealed wind trap somewhere on the surface to funnel air down here into cooler regions and precipitate the moisture from it." They passed through another rock door with latticework above it, and the door closed behind them. The draft of air at their backs carried a sensation of moisture clearly perceptible to both Jessica and Paul. At the head of the troop, the glow globe in Stilgar's hands dropped below the level of the heads in front of Paul. Presently he felt steps beneath his feet, curving down to the left. Light reflected back up across hooded heads, and a winding movement of people spiraling down the steps. Jessica sensed mounting tension in the people around her, a pressure of silence that rasped her nerves with its urgency. The steps ended, and the troop passed through another low door. The light of the glow globe was swallowed in a great open space with a high curved ceiling. Paul felt Chani's hand on his arm, heard a faint dripping sound in the chill air, felt an utter stillness come over the Fremen in the cathedral presence of water. "I have seen this place in a dream," he thought. The thought was both reassuring and frustrating. Somewhere ahead of him on this path, the fanatic hordes cut their gory path across the universe in his name. The green and black Atreides banner would become a symbol of terror. Wild legions would charge into battle, screaming their war cry, "Muad'Dib!" "It must not be," he thought. "I cannot let it happen." But he could feel the demanding race consciousness within him, his own terrible purpose, and he knew that no small thing could deflect the juggernaut. It was gathering weight and momentum. If he died this instant, the thing would go on through his mother and his unborn sister. Nothing less than the deaths of all the troop gathered here and now, himself and his mother included, could stop the thing. Paul stared around him, saw the troop spread out in a line. They pressed him forward against a low barrier carved from native rock. Beyond the barrier, in the glow of Stilgar's globe, Paul saw an unruffled, dark surface of water. It stretched away into shadows, deep and black, the far wall only faintly visible, perhaps 100 meters away. Jessica felt the dry pulling of skin on her cheeks and forehead relaxing in the presence of moisture. The water pool was deep. She could sense its deepness, and resisted a desire to dip her hands into it. A splashing sounded on her left. She looked down the shadowy line of Fremen, saw Stilgar with Paul standing beside him, and the watermasters emptying their load into the pool through a flow meter. The meter was a round gray eye above the pool's rim. She saw its glowing pointer move as the water flowed through it, saw the pointer stop at 33 liters, 7 3/32 seconds drachms. Superb accuracy in water measurement, Jessica thought. And she noted that the walls of the meter trough held no trace of moisture after the water's passage. The water flowed off those walls without binding tension. She saw a profound clue to Fremen technology in the simple fact they were perfectionists. Jessica worked her way down the barrier to Stilgar's side. Way was made for her with casual courtesy. She noted the withdrawn look in Paul's eyes, but the mystery of this great pool of water dominated her thoughts. Stilgar looked at her. "There were those among us in need of water," he said. "Yet they would come here and not touch this water. Do you know that?"
"I believe it," she said.
He looked at the pool. "We have more than 38 million decaliters here," he said. "Walled off from the little makers, hidden and preserved."
"A treasure trove," she said.
Stilgar lifted the globe to look into her eyes. "It is greater than treasure. We have thousands of such caches. Only a few of us know them all." He cocked his head to one side. The globe cast a yellow-shadowed glow across face and beard. "Hear that?" They listened. The dripping of water precipitated from the wind trap filled the room with its presence. Jessica saw that the entire troop was caught up in a rapture of listening. Only Paul seemed to stand remote from it. To Paul, the sound was like moments ticking away. He could feel time flowing through him, the instants never to be recaptured. He sensed a need for decision, but felt powerless to move. "It has been calculated with precision," Stilgar whispered. "We know to within a million decaliters how much we need. When we have it, we shall change the face of Arrakis." A hushed whisper of response lifted from the troop. "Bilal Kaifa." "We will trap the dunes beneath grass plantings," Stilgar said, his voice growing stronger. "We will tie the water into the soil with trees and undergrowth." "Bilal Kaifa," intoned the troop. "Each year the polar ice retreats," Stilgar said. "Bilal Kaifa," they chanted. "We shall make a home world of Arrakis, with melting lenses at the poles, with lakes in the temperate zones, and only the deep desert for the Maker and his spice. Bilal Kaifa. And no man ever again shall want for water. It shall be his for dipping from well or pond or lake or canal. It shall run down through the Kanats to feed our plants. It shall be there for any man to take. It shall be his for holding out his hand. Bilal Kaifa." Jessica felt the religious ritual in the words, noted her own instinctively awed response. "They are in league with the future," she thought. "They have their mountain to climb. This is the scientist's dream. And these simple people, these peasants, are filled with it." Her thoughts turned to Liet Kynes, the Emperor's planetary ecologist, the man who had gone native, and she wondered at him. This was a dream to capture men's souls, and she could sense the hand of the ecologist in it. This was a dream for which men would die willingly. It was another of the essential ingredients that she felt her son needed, people with a goal. Such people would be easy to imbue with fervor and fanaticism. They could be wielded like a sword to win back Paul's place for him. "We leave now," Stilgar said, "and wait for the first moon's rising. When Jamis is safely on his way, we will go home." Whispering their reluctance, the troop fell in behind him, turned back along the water barrier and up the stairs. And Paul, walking behind Chani, felt that a vital moment had passed him, that he had missed an essential decision and was now caught up in his own myth. He knew he had seen this place before, experienced it in a fragment of prescient dream on faraway Caladan, but details of the place were being filled in now that he had not seen. He felt a new sense of wonder at the limits of his gift. It was as though he rode within the wave of time, sometimes in its trough, sometimes on a crest. And all around him the other waves lifted and fell, revealing and then hiding what they bore on their surface. Through it all, the wild jihad still loomed ahead of him, the violence and the slaughter. It was like a promontory above the surf. The troop filed through the last door into the main cavern. The door was sealed. Lights were extinguished, hoods removed from the cavern openings, revealing the night and the stars that had come over the desert. Jessica moved to the dry lip of the cavern's edge, looked up at the stars. They were sharp and near. She felt the stirring of the troop around her, heard the sound of a baliset being tuned somewhere behind her, and Paul's voice humming the pitch. There was a melancholy in his tone that she did not like. Chani's voice intruded from the deep cave darkness. "Tell me about the waters of your birth world, Paul Muad'Dib." And Paul, "Another time, Chani. I promise." Such sadness. "It's a good baliset," Chani said.
"Very good," Paul said. "Do you think Jamis will mind my using it?"
"He speaks of the dead in the present tense," Jessica thought. The implications disturbed her. A man's voice intruded.
"He liked music betimes, Jamis did."
"Then sing me one of your songs," Chani pleaded. Such feminine allure in that girl child's voice, Jessica thought. I must caution Paul about their women, and soon.
"This was a song of a friend of mine," Paul said. "I expect he's dead now, Gurney is. He called it his even song." The troop grew still, listening as Paul's voice lifted in a sweet boy tenor with the baliset tinkling and strumming beneath it. "This clear time of seeing embers, a gold-bright sun is lost in first dusk. What frenzied senses, desperate musk, are consort of remembering." Jessica felt the verbal music in her breast, pagan and charged with sounds that made her suddenly and intensely aware of herself, feeling her own body and its needs. She listened with a tense stillness. "Night's pearl-censored requiem, 'tis for us. What joys run, then, bright in your eyes, what flower-spangled amours pull at our hearts, what flower-spangled amours fill our desires." And Jessica heard the after-stillness that hummed in the air with the last note. "Why does my son sing a love song to that girl child?" she asked herself. She felt an abrupt fear. She could sense life flowing around her, and she had no grasp on its reins. "Why did he choose that song?" she wondered. "The instincts are true sometimes. Why did he do this?" Paul sat silently in the darkness, a single stark thought dominating his awareness. "My mother is my enemy. She does not know it, but she is. She is bringing the jihad. She bore me. She trained me. She is my enemy."
The concept of progress acts as a protective mechanism to shield us from the terrors of the future. From Collected Sayings of Muad'Dib by the Princess Irulan.
On his 17th birthday, Fade Rautha Harkonnen killed his 100th slave gladiator in the family games. Visiting observers from the imperial court, a count and Lady Fenring, were on the Harkonnen homeworld of Gedi Prime for the event, invited to sit that afternoon with the immediate family in the golden box above the triangular arena. In honor of the Nab Baron's nativity, and to remind all Harkonnens and subjects that Fade Rautha was heir designate, it was holiday on Gedi Prime. The old Baron had decreed a meridian-to-meridian rest from labors. An effort had been spent in the family city of Harko to create the illusion of gaiety. Banners flew from buildings, new paint had been splashed on the walls along Court Way. But off the main way, Count Fenring and his lady noted the rubbish heaps, the scabrous brown walls reflected in the dark puddles of the streets, and the furtive scurrying of the people. In the Baron's blue-walled keep, there was fearful perfection. But the Count and his lady saw the price being paid. Guards everywhere, and weapons with that special sheen that told a trained eye they were in regular use. There were checkpoints for routine passage from area to area, even within the keep. The servants revealed their military training in the way they walked, in the set of their shoulders, in the way their eyes watched, and watched, and watched. "The pressure's on," the Count hummed to his lady in their secret language. "The Baron is just beginning to see the price he really paid to rid himself of the Duke Leto. Sometime I must recount for you the legend of the Phoenix," she said. They were in the reception hall of the keep, waiting to go to the family games. It was not a large hall, perhaps 40 meters long and half that in width. But false pillars along the sides had been shaped with an abrupt taper, and the ceiling had a subtle arch, all giving the illusion of much greater space. "Ah, here comes the Baron," the Count said. The Baron moved down the length of the hall with that peculiar waddling glide imparted by the necessities of guiding suspensor-hung weight. His jowls bobbed up and down. The suspensors jiggled and shifted beneath his orange robe. Rings glittered on his hands, and opifiers shone where they had been woven into the robe. At the Baron's elbow walked Fade Rotha. His dark hair was dressed in close ringlets that seemed incongruously gay above sullen eyes. He wore a tight-fitting black tunic and snug trousers with a suggestion of bell at the bottom. Soft-soled slippers covered his small feet. Lady Fenring, noting the young man's poise and the sure flow of muscles beneath the tunic, thought, "Here's one who won't let himself go to fat." The Baron stopped in front of them, took Fade Rautha's arm in a possessive grip, said,
"My nephew, the Nah Baron, Fade Rautha Harkonnen."
And turning his baby fat face toward Fade Rautha, he said,
"The Count and Lady Fenring, of whom I have spoken."
Fade Rautha dipped his head with the required courtesy. He stared at the Lady Fenring. She was golden-haired and willowy. Her perfection of figure clothed in a flowing gown of ecru, simple fitness of form without ornament. Gray-green eyes stared back at him. She had that Bene Gesserit serene repose about her that the young man found subtly disturbing. Said the Count. He studied Fade Rautha. The precise young man, my dear... The Count glanced at the Baron. "My dear Baron, you say you've spoken of us to this precise young man. What did you say?"
"I told my nephew of the great esteem our Emperor holds for you, Count Fenring,"
the Baron said. And he thought,
"Mark him well, Fade. A killer with the manners of a rabbit. This is the most dangerous kind."
"Of course," said the Count, and he smiled at his lady. Fade Rautha found the man's actions and words almost insulting. They stopped just short of something overt that would require notice. The young man focused his attention on the Count, a small man, weak-looking. The face was weaselish with over-large dark eyes. There was gray at the temples, and his movements... He moved a hand or turned his head one way, then he spoke another way. It was difficult to follow.
You come upon such preciseness so rarely," the Count said, addressing the Baron's shoulder. I congratulate you on the perfection of your air. In the light of the elder, one might say. "You are too kind," the Baron said.
He bowed, but Fade Rautha noted that his uncle's eyes did not agree with the courtesy. when you're ironic, that suggests you're thinking deep thoughts, the Count said. There he goes again, Fadrather thought. It sounds like he's being insulting, but there's nothing you can call out for satisfaction. Listening to the man gave Fadrather the feeling his head was being pushed through mush. Mom, Fadrather turned his attention back to the Lady Fenring. We're taking up too much of this young man's time, she said. I understand he's to appear in the arena today. By the houris of the Imperial Harem, she's a lovely one, Fadrather thought. He said, I shall make a kill for you this day, my lady. I shall make the dedication in the arena, with your permission. She returned his stare serenely, but her voice carried whiplash as she said, You do not have my permission.
Fade, the Baron said, and he thought, That imp, does he want this deadly Count to call him out?
But the Count only smiled and said,
You really must be getting ready for the arena, Fade, the Baron said. You must be rested and not take any foolish risks.
Fadrather bowed, his face dark with resentment. I'm sure everything will be as you wish, Uncle. He nodded to Count Fenring. Sir, to the lady, my lady. And he turned, strode out of the hall, barely glancing at the knot of families minor near the double doors.
He's so young, the Baron sighed.
Indeed, the Count said. And the Lady Fenring thought, Can that be the young man the Reverend Mother meant? Is that a bloodline we must preserve?
We've more than an hour before going to the arena, the Baron said. Perhaps we could have our little talk now, Count Fenring.
He tipped his gross head to the right.
There's a considerable amount of progress to be discussed.
And the Baron thought,
Let us see now how the Emperor's errand boy gets across whatever message he carries without ever being so crass as to speak it right out.
The Count spoke to his lady. You will excuse us, my dear. Each day, sometime each hour, brings change, she said. And she smiled sweetly at the Baron before turning away. Her long skirts swished, and she walked with a straight-backed, regal stride toward the double doors at the end of the hall. The Baron noted how all conversation among the houses minor there stopped at her approach. How the eyes followed her. Bene Gesserit, the Baron thought. The universe would be better rid of them all.
There's a cone of silence between two of the pillars over here on our left,
the Baron said.
We can't talk there without fear of being overheard.
He led the way with his waddling gait into the sound-deadening field, feeling the noises of the keep become dull and distant. The Count moved up beside the Baron, and they turned, facing the wall so their lips could not be read. "We're not satisfied with the way you ordered the Sardaukar off Arrakis," the Count said.
"Straight talk," the Baron thought. "The Sardaukar could not stay longer without risking that others would find out how the Emperor helped me," the Baron said.
"But your nephew Rabban does not appear to be pressing strongly enough toward a solution of the Fremen problem."
"What does the Emperor wish?"
the Baron asked.
"There cannot be more than a handful of Fremen left on Arrakis. The southern desert is uninhabitable. The northern desert is swept regularly by our patrols."
"Who says the southern desert is uninhabitable?"
"Your own planetologist said it, my dear Count."
"But Dr. Kynes is dead."
"Ah, yes. Unfortunate, that,"
"We've word from an overflight across the southern reaches," the Count said. "There's evidence of plant life."
"Has the Guild then agreed to a watch from space?"
"You know better than that, Baron. The Emperor cannot legally post a watch on Arrakis."
"And I cannot afford it,"
the Baron said.
"Who made this overflight?"
"A smuggler."
"Someone has lied to you, Count,"
the Baron said.
"Smugglers cannot navigate the southern reaches any better than can Raban's men. Storms, sand, static, and all that, you know. Navigation markers are knocked out faster than they can be installed."
"We'll discuss various types of static another time," the Count said.
"Ah,"
the Baron thought.
"Have you found some mistake in my accounting, then?"
he demanded. "When you imagine mistakes, there can be no self-defense," the Count said.
"He's deliberately trying to arouse my anger,"
the Baron thought. He took two deep breaths to calm himself. He could smell his own sweat, and the harness of the suspensors beneath his robe felt suddenly itchy and galling.
"The Emperor cannot be unhappy about the death of the concubine and the boy,"
the Baron said.
"They fled into the desert. There was a storm."
"Yes, there were so many convenient accidents," the Count agreed.
"I do not like your tone, Count,"
the Baron said. "Anger is one thing, violence another," the Count said. "Let me caution you. Should an unfortunate accident occur to me here, the great houses all would learn what you did on Arrakis. They've long suspected how you do business."
"The only recent business I can recall," the Baron said, "was transportation of several legions of Sardaukar to Arrakis."
"You think you could hold that over the Emperor's head?"
"I wouldn't think of it,"
the Count smiled. "Sardaukar commanders could be found who'd confess they acted without orders because they wanted a battle with your Fremen scum."
"Many might doubt such a confession,"
the Baron said, but the threat staggered him.
"Are Sardaukar truly that disciplined?"
he wondered. "The Emperor does wish to audit your books," the Count said.
"Any time."
You have no objections?"
"None. My Chom Company directorship will bear the closest scrutiny."
And he thought,
"Let him bring a false accusation against me and have it exposed. I shall stand there Promethean, saying, 'Behold me, I am wronged.' Then let him bring any other accusation against me, even a true one. The great houses will not believe a second attack from an accuser once proved wrong."
"No doubt your books will bear the closest scrutiny," the Count muttered.
"Why is the Emperor so interested in exterminating the Fremen?"
the Baron asked. "You wish the subject to be changed, eh?" the Count shrugged. "It is the Sardaukar who wish it, not the Emperor. They needed practice in killing, and they hate to see a task left undone."
"Does he think to frighten me by reminding me that he is supported by bloodthirsty killers?"
the Baron wondered.
"A certain amount of killing has always been an arm of business,"
the Baron said.
"But a line has to be drawn somewhere. Someone must be left to work the spice."
The Count emitted a short, barking laugh. "You think you can harness the Fremen?"
"There never were enough of them for that," the Baron said. "But the killing has made the rest of my population uneasy. It's reaching the point where I'm considering another solution to the Arrakeen problem, my dear Fenring. And I must confess the Emperor deserves credit for the inspiration.
Ah?
You see, Count, I have the Emperor's prison planet, Salusa Secundus, to inspire me.
The Count stared at him with glittering intensity. What possible connection is there between Arrakis and Salusa Secundus? The Baron felt the alertness in Fenring's eyes, said,
No connection yet.
Yet?
You must admit it'd be a way to develop a substantial workforce on Arrakis. Use the place as a prison planet.
You anticipate an increase in prisoners?
There has been unrest,
the Baron admitted.
I've had to squeeze rather severely, Fenring. After all, you know the price I paid that damnable guild to transport our mutual force to Arrakis. That money has to come from somewhere.
I suggest you not use Arrakis as a prison planet without the Emperor's permission, Baron.
Of course not,
the Baron said, and he wondered at the sudden chill in Fenring's voice. Another matter, the Count said. We learned that Duke Leto's mentat, Thufir Hawat, is not dead but in your employ.
I could not bring myself to waste him,
the Baron said. You lied to our Sardaukar commander when you said Hawat was dead.
Only a white lie, my dear Count. I hadn't the stomach for a long argument with the man.
Was Hawat the real traitor?
Oh, goodness, no. It was the false doctor.
The Baron wiped at perspiration on his neck.
You must understand, Fenring, I was without a mentat. You know that. I've never been without a mentat. It was most unsettling.
How could you get Hawat to shift allegiance?
His duke was dead,
the Baron forced a smile.
There's nothing to fear from Hawat, my dear Count. The mentat's flesh has been impregnated with a latent poison. We administer an antidote in his meals. Without the antidote, the poison is triggered. He'd die in a few days.
Withdraw the antidote, the Count said.
But he's useful.
And he knows too many things no living man should know.
You said the Emperor doesn't fear exposure.
Don't play games with me, Baron.
When I see such an order above the Imperial Seal, I'll obey it,
the Baron said.
But I'll not submit to your whim.
You think it whim?
What else can it be? The Emperor has obligations to me, too, Fenring. I rid him of the troublesome duke.
With the help of a few Sardaukar.
Where else would the Emperor have found a house to provide the disguising uniforms to hide his hand in this matter?
He has asked himself the same question, Baron, but with a slightly different emphasis. The Baron studied Fenring, noting the stiffness of jaw muscles, the careful control.
Ah, now, the Baron said, I hope the Emperor doesn't believe he can move against me in total secrecy.
He hopes it won't become necessary.
The Emperor cannot believe I threaten him.
The Baron permitted anger and grief to edge his voice, thinking,
Let him wrong me in that. I could place myself on the throne while still beating my breast over how I'd been wronged.
The Count's voice went dry and remote as he said, The Emperor believes what his senses tell him.
Dare the Emperor charge me with treason before a full Landstrad council?
And the Baron held his breath with the hope of it. The Emperor need dare nothing. The Baron whirled away in his suspenses to hide his expression.
It could happen in my lifetime, he thought. Emperor, let him wrong me. Then the bribes and coercion, the rallying of the great houses, they'd flock to my banner like peasants running for shelter. The thing they fear above all else is the Emperor's Sardaukar loosed upon them one house at a time.
It's the Emperor's sincere hope. He'll never have to charge you with treason, the Count said. The Baron found it difficult to keep irony out of his voice and permit only the expression of hurt, but he managed.
I've been a most loyal subject. These words hurt me beyond my capacity to express.
Said the Count. The Baron kept his back to the Count, nodding. Presently he said,
It's time to go to the arena.
Indeed, said the Count. They moved out of the cone of silence and side by side walked toward the clumps of houses minor at the end of the hall. A bell began a slow tolling somewhere in the keep, 20-minute warning for the arena gathering. The houses minor wait for you to lead them, the Count said, nodding toward the people they approached.
Double meaning. Double meaning,
the Baron thought. He looked up at the new talismans flanking the exit to his hall. The mounted bull's head and the oil painting of the old Duke Atreides, the late Duke Leto's father. They filled the Baron with an odd sense of foreboding, and he wondered what thoughts these talismans had inspired in the Duke Leto as they hung in the halls of Caladan, and then on Arrakis, the bravura father and the head of the bull that had killed him. Mankind has only one science, the Count said as they picked up their parade of followers and emerged from the hall into the waiting room, a narrow space with high windows and floor of patterned white and purple tile.
And what science is that?
The Baron asked. It's the science of discontent, the Count said. The houses minor behind them, sheep-faced and responsive, laughed with just the right tone of appreciation. But the sound carried a note of discord as it collided with the sudden blast of motors that came to them when pages threw open the outer doors, revealing the line of ground cars, their guide on penance whipping in a breeze. The Baron raised his voice to surmount the sudden noise, said,
I hope you'll not be discontented with the performance of my nephew today, Count Fenring.
I am filled only with a sense of anticipation, yes, the Count said. Always in the, process verbal, one must consider the, office of origin. The Baron did his sudden stiffening of surprise by stumbling on the first step down from the exit.
Process verbal. That was a report of a crime against the Imperium.
But the Count chuckled to make it seem a joke and patted the Baron's arm. All the way to the arena, though, the Baron sat back among the armored cushions of his car, casting covert glances at the Count beside him, wondering why the Emperor's errand boy had thought it necessary to make that particular kind of joke in front of the house's minor. It was obvious that Fenring seldom did anything he felt to be unnecessary, or used two words where one would do, or held himself to a single meaning in a single phrase. They were seated in the golden box above the triangular arena, horns blaring, the tiers above and around them jammed with a hubbub of people and waving pennants, when the answer came to the Baron. My dear Baron, the Count said, leaning close to his ear, you know, don't you, that the Emperor has not given official sanction to your choice of heir? The Baron felt himself to be within a sudden personal cone of silence produced by his own shock. He stared at Fenring, barely seeing the Count's lady come through the guards beyond to join the party in the golden box. That's really why I'm here today, the Count said. The Emperor wishes me to report on whether you've chosen a worthy successor. There's nothing like the arena to expose the true person from beneath the mask, eh?
The Emperor promised me free choice of heir,
the Baron grated. We shall see, Fenring said, and turned away to greet his lady.
She sat down, smiling at the Baron, then giving her attention to the sand floor beneath them, where Fade Rotha was emerging in guiles and tights. The black glove and the long knife in his right hand, the white glove and the short knife in his left hand.
"White for poison, black for purity," the Lady Fenring said. "A curious custom, isn't it, my love?"
The Count said.
The greeting cheer lifted from the family galleries, and Fade Rotha paused to accept it, looking up and scanning the faces, seeing his cousines and cousins, the demi-brothers, the concubines, and out-frame relations. There were so many pink trumpet mouths yammering amidst a flutter of colorful clothing and banners. It came to Fade Rotha then that the packed ranks of faces would look just as avidly at his blood as at that of the slave gladiator. There was not a doubt of the outcome in this fight, of course. Here was only the form of danger without its substance. Yet Fade Rotha held up his knives to the sun, saluted the three corners of the arena in the ancient manner. The short knife in white-gloved hand, white, the sign of poison, went first into its sheath, then the long blade in the black-gloved hand, the pure blade that now was unpure, his secret weapon to turn this day into a purely personal victory. Poison on the black blade. The adjustment of his body shield took only a moment, and he paused to sense the skin tightening at his forehead, assuring him he was properly guarded. This moment carried its own suspense, and Fade Rotha dragged it out with the sure hand of a showman. Nodding to his handlers and distractors, checking their equipment with a measuring stare. Gyves in place with their prickles sharp and glistening, the barbs and hooks waving with their blue streamers. Fade Rotha signaled the musicians. The slow march began, sonorous with its ancient pomp, and Fade Rotha led his troop across the arena for obeisance at the foot of his uncle's box. He caught the ceremonial key as it was thrown. The music stopped. Into the abrupt silence, he stepped back two paces, raised the key and shouted, "I dedicate this truth to—" And he paused, knowing his uncle would think, "The young fool's going to dedicate to Lady Fenring after all and cause a ruckus." "To my uncle and patron, the Baron Vladimir Harkonnen," Fade Rotha shouted. And he was delighted to see his uncle sigh. The music resumed at the quick march, and Fade Rotha led his men scampering back across the arena to the prudence door that admitted only those wearing the proper identification band. Fade Rotha prided himself that he never used the prude door and seldom needed distractors. But it was good to know they were available this day. Special plans sometimes involved special dangers. Again, silence settled over the arena. Fade Rotha turned, faced the big red door across from him through which the gladiator would emerge. The special gladiator.
This ends Disc 13. Dune, Disc 14.
The plan Thufir Hawat had devised was admirably simple and direct, Fade Rotha thought. The slave would not be drugged. That was the danger. Instead, a key word had been drummed into the man's unconscious to immobilize his muscles at a critical instant. Fade Rotha rolled the vital word in his mind, mouthing it without sound. Scum. To the audience, it would appear that an undrugged slave had been slipped into the arena to kill Dinar Baron, and all the carefully arranged evidence would point to the slave master. A low humming arose from the red door's servo motors as they were armed for opening. Fade Rotha focused all his awareness on the door. This first moment was the critical one. The appearance of the gladiator as he emerged told the trained eye much it needed to know. All gladiators were supposed to be hyped on Elaka drug to come out kill-ready in fighting stance. But you had to watch how they hefted the knife, which way they turned in defense, whether they were actually aware of the audience in the stands.
The way a slave cocked his head could give the most vital clue to counter and feint. The red door slammed open. Out charged a tall, muscular man with shaved head and darkly pitted eyes. His skin was carrot-colored, as it should be from the Alaka drug, but Feyd-Ratha knew the color was paint. The slave wore green leotards and the red belt of a semi-shield, the belt's arrow pointing left to indicate the slave's left side was shielded. He held his knife sword-fashion, cocked slightly outward in the stance of a trained fighter. Slowly he advanced into the arena, turning his shielded side toward Feyd-Ratha and the group at the Prue door.
"I like not the look of this one," said one of Feyd-Ratha's barb men. "Are you sure he's drugged, my lord?"
"He has the color," Feyd-Ratha said.
"Yet he stands like a fighter,"
said another helper. Feyd-Ratha advanced two steps onto the sand, studying the slave.
"What has he done to his arm?" asked one of the distractors.
Feyd-Ratha's attention went to a bloody scratch on the man's left forearm, followed the arm down to the hand as it pointed to a design drawn in blood on the left hip of the green leotards. A wet shape there. The formalized outline of a hawk.
Hawk.
Feyd-Ratha looked up into the darkly pitted eyes, saw them glaring at him with uncommon alertness. "It's one of Duke Leto's fighting men we took on Arrakis," Feyd-Ratha thought. "No simple gladiator, this." A chill ran through him, and he wondered if Howard had another plan for this arena. A feint within a feint within a feint. And only the slave master prepared to take the blame. Feyd-Ratha's chief handler spoke at his ear.
"I like not the look on that one, my lord. Let me set a barb or two in his knife arm to try him."
"I'll set my own barbs," Feyd-Ratha said. He took a pair of the long, hooked shafts from the handler, hefted them, testing the balance. These barbs, too, were supposed to be drugged, but not this time, and the chief handler might die because of that, but it was all part of the plan.
"You'll come out of this a hero," Hawat had said. "Killed your gladiator man to man, and in spite of treachery, the slave master will be executed and your man will step into his spot."
Feyd-Ratha advanced another 5 paces into the arena, playing out the moment, studying the slave. Already, he knew, the experts in the stands above him were aware that something was wrong. The gladiator had the correct skin color for a drugged man, but he stood his ground and did not tremble. The aficionados would be whispering among themselves now. "See how he stands. He should be agitated, attacking or retreating. See how he conserves his strength, how he waits. He should not wait." Feyd-Ratha felt his own excitement kindle.
"Let there be treachery in Hawat's mind," he thought. "I can handle the slave. And it's my long knife that carries the poison this time, not the short one. Even Hawat doesn't know that."
"Hi, Harkonnen," the slave called. "Are you prepared to die?"
Deathly stillness gripped the arena. Slaves did not issue the challenge. Now, Feyd-Ratha had a clear view of the gladiator's eyes, saw the cold ferocity of despair in them. He marked the way the man stood, loose and ready, muscles prepared for victory. The slave Grapevine had carried Hawat's message to this one. "You'll get a true chance to kill the Na Baron." That much of the scheme was as they'd planned it, then. A tight smile crossed Feyd-Ratha's mouth. He lifted the barbs, seeing success for his plans in the way the gladiator stood.
"Hi, hi," the slave challenged, and crept forward 2 steps.
"No one in the galleries can mistake it now," Feyd-Ratha thought. This slave should have been partly crippled by drug-induced terror. Every movement should have betrayed his inner knowledge that there was no hope for him. He could not win. He should have been filled with the stories of the poisons the Na Baron chose for the blade in his white-gloved hand. The Na Baron never gave quick death. He delighted in demonstrating rare poisons, could stand in the arena pointing out interesting side effects on a writhing victim. There was fear in the slave, yes, but not terror. Fade Rautha lifted the barbs high, nodded in an almost greeting. The gladiator pounced. His feint and defensive counter were as good as any Fade Rautha had ever seen. A timed side blow missed by the barest fraction from severing the tendons of the Nabaran's left leg. Fade Rautha danced away, leaving a barbed shaft in the slave's right forearm, the hooks completely buried in flesh where the man could not withdraw them without ripping tendons. A concerted gasp lifted from the galleries. The sound filled Fade Rautha with elation. He knew now what his uncle was experiencing, sitting up there with the Fenrings, the observers from the Imperial Court beside him. There could be no interference with this fight. The forms must be observed in front of witnesses, and the Baron would interpret the events in the arena only one way. Threat to himself. The slave backed, holding knife in teeth and lashing the barbed shaft to his arm with the pennant. "I do not feel your needle," he shouted. Again he crept forward, knife ready, left side presented, his body bent backward to give it the greatest surface of protection from the half-shield. That action, too, didn't escape the galleries. Sharp cries came from the family boxes. Fade Rautha's handlers were calling out to ask if he needed them. He waved them back to the Prue door. "I'll give them a show such as they've never had before," Fade Rautha thought. "No tame killing where they can sit back and admire the style. This'll be something to take them by the guts and twist them. When I'm Baron, they'll remember this day, and won't be a one of them can escape fear of me because of this day." Fade Rautha gave ground slowly before the gladiator's crab-like advance. Arena sand grated underfoot. He heard the slaves panting, smelled his own sweat and a faint odor of blood on the air. Steadily, the Nabaran moved backward, turning to the right, his second barb ready. The slave danced sideways. Fade Rautha appeared to stumble, heard the scream from the galleries. Again the slave pounced. "Gods, what a fighting man," Fade Rautha thought as he leaped aside. Only youth's quickness saved him, but he left the second barb buried in the deltoid muscle of the slave's right arm. Shrill cheers rained from the galleries. "They cheer me now," Fade Rautha thought. He heard the wildness in the voices, just as Howard had said he would. They'd never cheered a family fighter that way before. And he thought with an edge of grimness on a thing Howard had told him, it's easier to be terrified by an enemy you admire. Swiftly, Fade Rautha retreated to the center of the arena, where all could see clearly. He drew his long blade, crouched, and waited for the advancing slave. The man took only the time to lash the second barb tight to his arm, then sped in pursuit. "Let the family see me do this thing," Fade Rautha thought. "I am their enemy. Let them think of me as they see me now." He drew his short blade. "I do not fear you, Harkonnen swine," the gladiator said. "Your tortures cannot hurt a dead man. I can be dead on my own blade before a handler lays finger to my flesh, and I'll have you dead beside me." Fade Rautha grinned, offered now the long blade, the one with the poison. "Try this on," he said, and feinted with the short blade in his other hand. The slave shifted knife hands, turned inside, both parry and feint, to grapple the Nabaran's short blade, the one in the white-gloved hand that tradition said should carry the poison. "You will die, Harkonnen," the gladiator gasped. They struggled sideways across the sand. Where Fade Rautha's shield met the slave's half-shield, a blue glow marked the contact. The air around them filled with ozone from the field. "Die on your own poison," the slave grated. He began forcing the white-gloved hand inward, turning the blade he thought carried the poison. "Let them see this," Fade Rautha thought. He brought down the long blade, felt it clang uselessly against the barbed shaft lashed to the slave's arm. Fade Rautha felt a moment of desperation. He hadn't thought the barbed shafts would be an advantage for the slave, but they gave the man another shield. And the strength of this gladiator! The short blade was being forced inward inexorably, and Fade Rautha focused on the fact that a man could also die on an unpoisoned blade. "Scum!" Fade Rautha gasped. At the key word, the gladiator's muscles obeyed with a momentary slackness. It was enough for Fade Rautha. He opened a space between them sufficient for the long blade. Its poison tip flicked out, drew a red line down the slave's chest. There was instant agony in the poison. The man disengaged himself, staggered backward. "Now let my dear family watch."